G'day, this is Paul Bedford, author of The List, and you're listening to Behind the Panels.
They can be a great people, Kal-El. They wish to be. They only lack the light to show the way. For this reason, above all, their capacity for good. I have sent them you. My only son.
My spider senses are starting to tingle.
Just hang on to your lariat.
Wonder what kind of a scene I'm getting into.
Welcome to issue 67 of Behind the Panels, the comic book podcast that was exposed to radiation in a freak accident and now feels a little bit sick. I'm Richard Gray.
And I'm David McVeigh.
In this issue, a classic DC character flashes Arrow and Samuel L. Jackson lays furious vengeance on Colin Firth. Then Australian comics take on the US industry while everybody else comes to Sydney as Graphic and Oz Comic Con announce their lineups. Plus, our kick-ass pick of the week, The List, by Paul Bedford and Henry Popp, with very special guest Paul Bedford to talk about his graphic novel. This is Behind the Panels.
Just getting my groove on.
Oh, yeah, what an opening. That was, of course, Tool with the song Parabola. And we know that Paul Bedford is a massive Tool fan, so that's for you, Paul.
Oh, there you go. And Paul will be joining us a little bit later on the show.
Yes, but Paul's joining us for the second half of the show.
Absolutely. So we're looking forward to that. But before then.
Yes.
What we got, Richard?
Well, it's usually about this time of the week that I hit up the Wayback Machine and I take us back to a vintage clip of the week, David. And I've been tinkering with the desktop theme of the Wayback Machine this week. So let's see if we can get out of the 80s. But I think we're still stuck in the 80s this week. But let's see where it takes us.
All right.
Please, may I have Mr. Bone the Baker?
No, he's not at home.
I've raised 20 Cobstoppers.
But while Eric and the babysitter played their innocent game of happy families, sinister forces were plotting the destruction of Banana Man. Yes, fans, it was evil General Blight and his old school chum, Dr. Gloom.
I tell you, Doctor, I could take over the world if it weren't for Banana Man. Sometimes I think he's indestructible.
But we don't have to destroy him, BG.
I told you never to use that name.
Anyway, I can deal with the big banana. Just get into my suit. Leave the rest to me.
We have just heard that unless Banana Man appears in person to negotiate with Dr. Gloom, the world will end at midnight, and the late night movie will be cancelled.
Gosh, there's no time to lose.
But where is this Dr. Gloom?
42A, the railway company. But hurry, Banana Man.
That sound effect and the word Banana Man together.
I said last week that we were going to get away from Amazing Spider-Man, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, and I said maybe I'll play Banana Man or something. So
There it is.
I played Banana Man or something. Banana Man was a show I watched a lot as a kid. So it was originally, the character was created in 1980 as a comic book originally, and it was originally appeared in Nutty as a sort of a back page strip. in this British magazine called Nutty, and it sort of went on to appear in things like The Dandy and the infamous Beano.
Right. But, I still love Beano.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's that sort of humour, and they were voiced by most of the cast of The Goodies, I think.
Right, right.
Did that. But the character itself was actually sort of an amalgam of... it was a parody of Superman and shades of Captain Marvel, and of course his British twin Marvel Man. And as the Wikipedia entry says, he was occasionally kind of the eccentric humor was similar to what Alan Moore was doing around the time,
right? Right.
With Captain Britain, so it was that kind of feel to it. So I remember watching it at the time, but of course none of that I would have seen.
No, you wouldn't have got any of that at the time. You would have just saw Banana Man.
Banana Man, which was an awesome, fun show because I liked The Goodies as well.
And are we ready? Do the funky Gibbon, funky Gibbon. We could see what vintage we are, can't we?
The TV show was, of course, from 1983, and that was from episode one, the Banana Man meets Dr. Gloom.
And didn't he sound like Peter Lorre?
Yeah.
I will take him to the chamber.
I love that. So that was our interview for this week. I'd have to see what else I can unearth in the future.
Yes, it'll be very curious to see if you can continue this. I mean, after this long, I'm surprised you keep finding stuff.
I keep finding things, David, because they're there to be uncovered.
Well, let's see where our crazy new Wayback Machine takes us.
I quite like that new crazy Wayback Machine, although there's part of me that kind of thinks it needs to bring us back afterwards.
Yeah, we should have a return lever.
Yeah.
David, it's usually about this time of the week that we look back and see what we've been reading. And I don't think either of us have been overwhelmed with reading this week, but let's hit up this button and see what it does.
Where? Looks like we got ourselves a reader. Read between the lines, bitch.
So that's what happened when I hit that button and that sound
that,
effect.
That's what happens. Yeah, that's what plays that.
I wonder every week I say this. I'm going to hit this button, see what happens. And then that always happens.
It's pretty amazing. It's pretty consistent, actually. Yeah. I would think there's one thing that we probably both read. Mm. I don't know. I haven't spoken to you before. But did you read the end of The Enemy Within? The Captain Marvel?
No.
Okay,
no,
I did.
Actually.
I did. And I'm not going to spoil it for you at all. But it has a very surprise ending.
Uh-huh.
And I'm put it this way. I'm very curious to know what they're going to do with this now.
Well, the reason I haven't been reading a lot of comics this week, well, I've been reading a lot of comics, but I was actually writing, if you've been to the site, you would have seen I put up a history of Green Arrow.
It's fantastic, people.
Thank you very much. It's a bit of a labor of love, because we all know that I love Green Arrow. And so what I've decided to go back and do is a history of Green Arrow from the beginning all the way through to now. And I started writing this, my intention was to write it as one piece. And then I started writing, looking at the different histories that were out there, and I thought, none of them have been as comprehensive as I'd like. So part one is about 3,000 words with a lot of pictures in there. And that just covers 1940s through the 1960s. So part two is coming soon, which will be basically the 70s, about hard traveling hero stuff.
Can I throw a spoiler out there?
Yeah.
And just say that I actually had a look at a little bit of a draft of this.
Yes.
And you have embedded...
Yes.
The video, the infamous video that has all of those sound clips, like...
Wonder what kind of a scene I'm getting into.
Which is fantastic, because I've never actually seen the video. So it was great to actually put it into context.
And when you saw it, the first thing you said was...
Great flaming arrows.
I did indeed.
So we're talking about that era.
Yeah.
Where Ollie just basically turned into a jerk. For 6 years.
It's kind of when he turned into the greeny left-wing radical.
Well, there was a thing. Now, this is just a little bit of a thing from the first part. Justice League 66 is the issue where it all kind of just changes, where Dennis O'Neill took over the book, and he took over Justice League of America, and he took a shine to...
about to say shiny. Red Rum.
took a shine to Green Arrow.
And his father took an axe to him.
Here's Ollie.
He made him into the kind of left, politically left,
and God love him for it.
Fighter for the social injustice.
Because it's really interesting looking at part one of your article where Green Arrow is so white bread.
It is.
It's like chesty bonds in green.
And this weird stuff, like I didn't realize that he was like, Well, apart from the fact that Jack Kirby wanted to make everything space-bound, you know, that he wanted to make him a little bit science fiction and he had his ideas kind of modified. There was also that Green Arrow's original origin, before the island origin, was that he was an archaeologist with who'd lived on an Indian reservation. It was an Indian reservation in those days, not a Native American reservation.
No, of course.
Growing up, and where he learnt, you know...
Because they were the red men.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Where he admired archery skills.
Their words, not mine, people.
Yeah.
Okay. keep your letters at home.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. We're talking about
it's historical.
A simpler time of comics. And, you know, we were...
This is when we had Apache Chief.
No, this is even before we had Apache Chief. You know, and this is, you know, he basically learnt the craft to the Arrow from them. That's where he met Roy Harper there. Later on, that was all retconned with...
With his leaf suit.
With his leaf suit, yeah. He makes a green leaf suit, which you could say was the first Green Arrow costume.
Yeah, but what I loved about that leaf suit was the fact that he actually fashioned a little leaf hat with a red feather in it.
Well, you gotta, you know, be camouflaged
with the red feather.
Well, actually, that story is ridiculous because it's basically it was Mort Weisinger who was the original person who wrote the Green Arrow didn't do an origin story. It was much later that he did that Indian story, and then but it wasn't until Jack Kirby that we got that original. And that was when Jack Kirby was both writing and doing the art. He only did it for a handful of issues. But he probably wrote the single most important story to Green Arrow's history, which was the island being stranded on the island, which has been used in every variation ever since, right up until the TV show Arrow.
Mm.
And he wrote that in there. But the premise of the reason he has to go back to the island is because there are people arriving there and he has to go... When he was on the island the first time, he chiseled his life story and his name into a wall. And he needs to go back and cover it up so no one can know that he's Green Arrow. Simpler times, people.
I think you need a statue of Arrow in the leaf costume. Yeah,
that DC Direct. I'm putting it out there. If you don't do that statue leaf one, I'm fashioning one out of, you know, modeling clay right now.
That's awesome. No, it really is. It's a really good read because, I mean, for somebody who, I mean, I like Arrow, but my Arrow started from Green Lantern, Green Arrow.
I don't
really know anything before that. So it was really interesting going back and seeing Chesty Bonds in their leaf suit.
So, stick around. If you haven't read that, please go and read it. It's just in the new article section on the site. And look out for part two probably towards the end of the month.
That's fantastic. That's very good. Now, the other thing that I read this week is I continued reading it because I've read very little. It's been a very busy week. But I did read a couple of things because there's always those little things you have to read. Of course, we read the list as well, which is something we'll talk about much later. But I also continue reading the one book, aside from Snyder's Batman, which I think is probably still the shining light of DC. The one book that I have continually read since the New 52 kicked off, and I've actually really enjoyed, and in particular the most recent issues, is Batgirl. Batgirl's gone into some really weird-ass places.
I've really got to catch up.
And at the moment, we're in this crisis situation where she's actually now thinking she can't be Batgirl anymore. I will not spoil it, but I will say that she's killed someone. And because of that, she's at this turning point in her life.
Interesting.
So it is a very interesting, and she's in this absolute depression. And so it's going to, it's really well written, it's really well drawn.
This is Gail Simone's
story. Gail Simone's story still. And yeah, I do recommend going out and having a look at catching up with Batgirl if you get a chance, because it's gone into some really interesting places.
It's good. I'm glad that's going well, because Birds of Prey has really gone off the rails.
I've gone off Birds of Prey. Yeah. I stopped reading Birds of Prey after the Ivy storyline.
One of my fellow Newsarama writers refers to it as Birds of Cliche.
Yeah, it's a little bit that way. I was reading it every week up until the whole Ivy turns on the team storyline, and then kind of went, all right, I'm bored now, I'm out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I know the feeling. And which is probably characterized a lot of the DC stuff. You know, some of the other stuff that's come out last week, I think we mentioned Hunger last week, and there's been... I read the What If AVX series. That was kind of fun.
I read the first one, and I haven't gone any further.
It's a far more satisfying conclusion. The one thing I'm just going to give a massive plug to, because I've plugged it on every possible platform I can, and is Amala's Blade. It's a four-issue miniseries from Dark Horse by Steve Horton, and I love this book so much. I gave the final issue 10 out of 10, and that's really a body of work kind of thing, because This story is just, if you like pirate stories, if you like cyberpunk and steampunk and ghost stories and adventure stories, all of it is there in this one book.
Wow, sounds
and,
good.
And it's basically this assassin, Amala, is sent off to, and there's basically two warring factions, the Purifiers, who are kind of old school, they still have, you know, guns and swords and tanks, and there's the Modifiers, who have kind of got these cybernetic kind of things, but it's all in kind of a steampunky cyber, you know, kind of way, and it's all sort of anachronistic in that sense. But it's just so much fun. It's one of those things that's missing from a lot of other comics, just being so damn fun.
I'm going to have to... I've got them. I've actually been collecting it since it came out. I just haven't got to it yet.
And I love the art style. Support these guys. The trade paperback's coming out in January. I think it's about January 22nd, they said. So full disclosure, I talk to these guys all the time on Twitter, and they really appreciate all the plugging I've given to them.
Do we feel this as being a pick of the week coming up?
I absolutely should be pick of the week at some stage. I mean, cool. I've covered it well and truly on the site, behindthepanels.net, and on Newsarama as well.
If we make it a pick of the week, it'll actually kick me up the butt to actually finally read it.
So. Well, there you go. So we'll do that in an upcoming episode. But again, while we're on the topic, people, if you've got any picks that you'd like us to do, hit us up at feedback@behindthepanels.net or on the Facebook at facebook.com.
Let us know what you've been reading. Because we keep our feelers out there and we're always looking for new stuff, but we can't see it all. So
I do actually. I have actually borrowed. This is just for because we've been requested to read this a number of occasions. I have a copy because a friend lent it to me of Johnny the Homicidal Maniac.
Oh, okay.
So, and it's... completely batshit crazy, and I'm loving it. So it's thank you for the recommend.
The other one that's batshit crazy that I've been trying to get you to read for a while is Nancy Goes to Hell. So we'll have to do that as a big just to make
yes. I think Johnny the Homicidal Maniac is real comics with an X. You know, it's it's that kind of stuff. So it's check it out, people.
Cool.
Right. So around this time, we usually talk about the news. So David, do you want to do that this week?
Was there any news this week? Let's find out.
Let's find out. The CW introduced The Flash in a three-part episode of Arrow Season 2 as a backdoor pilot to a new series starring the DC Comics Speedster.
Graphic 2013 has announced at the Sydney Opera House in October. Guests will include Grant Morrison, Gerard Way, Art Spiegelman, Dave McKean, Len Wein, and Robot Chicken Live.
A direct-to-video adaptation of Image Comics' Chew is being planned, with a potential live-action series to follow.
Samuel L. Jackson is to play the villain in Matthew Vaughn's take on Mark Millar and Dave Gibbons' graphic novel The Secret Service. Good book.
Miles Teller is reported to be the frontrunner to play Reed Richards in the Fantastic Four reboot from Fox.
Snooze. Oz Comic Con has added William Shatner, Gigi Edgley, Jason Momoa, and Chris Judge to the inaugural Brisbane and Sydney legs of the 2014 circuit. See you there.
Finally, Australia's ABC2 will be screening the two-part documentary Comic Book Heroes from August, the inside story of Gestalt Comics' attempts to crack the US market. I think this was debuted originally down at the Oz Comic Con in Melbourne, and they've been working on it for something like 2 years already. And Gestalt, of course, are the publishers of things like The Deep, and we've spoken to Justin Randall, and he's been changing
and,
ways.
The Eldridge Kid.
Eldridge Kid, of course, Christian Reid. So here's a little bit of a taste of the trailer.
I reject the idea of needing to be in the US to make it in the comics industry.
One way to get published is to make your own publishing company. And so basically that's what Wolf and I did.
It's highly critical this year to be at San Diego and to succeed there.
If you're an Australian publisher and you're trying to make it big in the American market, I mean, you've really got a challenge ahead of you.
At this point, the books that were supposed to have arrived today have not, so things are slightly tense in my head.
Comic-Con is kind of like Christmas for those of us that love pop culture.
Cool course, featuring an obligatory appearance by Kevin Smith.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's got Comic-Con. It's got... Now, can we just backtrack the news a little bit here and just say Robot Chicken Live?
Yeah, they're going to do a live reading.
How do you do Robot Chicken
Live? I think
they're
going to do a live reading of Robot Chicken or
something. That's kind of intriguing.
That's going to be cool. Look, Graphic's an amazing annual thing that they do at the Sydney Opera House. And they've had all sorts of people out here. They had Kevin Smith out a few years ago. They had... I think it was Neil Gaiman they had out a few years ago as well. This year, I think it's probably their best lineup. You heard that earlier. I
mean, look, Grant Morrison alone would have been reason to go, but Art Spiegelman?
Grant Morrison's doing two things. He's doing an In Conversation with Gerard Way, who's the ex-frontman of My Chemical Romance, and he's currently writing a book that I've been plugging called The True Lives of the Fabulous Killjoys.
Right, right.
He's also doing a panel discussion with Dave McKean and Len Wein. Len Wein, for those of you who don't remember the name, is the co-creator of Wolverine. And Dave McKean was the original artist on Sandman.
Mm-hmm.
This is a heavy hitter group of people.
So have we been accredited for this yet?
I've been hitting them up as hard as I can, so I may have to phone them soon. But look, yeah, definitely get along to that if you're in Sydney. If you're not, travel to Sydney. It's going to be big. And a lot of the stuff isn't that expensive. Like, the tickets are about $30 for that Grant Morrison panel. So definitely worth checking out if you're a fan.
I think it's going to be awesome. And the other part in the news that we quickly ran straight over, there is actually an article all about from you on the site.
Yep.
Which is The Flash.
The Flash, yes. It can be a new Flash TV series.
That's absolutely amazing. But more importantly, no superpowers was the mantra. Superpowers was the mantra of Arrow.
Well, the way they've gotten around this is they're saying, like, yes, it's not superpowers in the traditional sense, but they said they can ground him because his was a science experiment gone wrong. So his is almost a more realistic origin story. But then again, if they... They've kind of opened the door here, and if they want to tie this into Man of Steel,
which
or
makes
any of those
sense
things,
for them to do that, because this is exactly what Marvel is doing with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
So I think they've taken a page out of that, and they basically said, "Well, if Marvel's going to do that, we have to use Arrow as a test bed."
Yeah.
And they're going to use it. And basically, they can start. My theory about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is the same as the theory about this, which is they can then put in sub characters who they're not sure if they'll work or not, see if they're popular, and if they are, they can spin them off into films or into their own series.
Part B is that they've put Wonder Woman on hold, Amazon on hold.
But there's a lot of talk about a Wonder Woman film now.
I think they'd be mad not to do a Wonder Woman film.
I agree. I think Wonder Woman is probably the second, if not third, most famous DC character.
Well, it's the
known. It's the Trinity. And I think there are a lot of people who would go see it.
Because there's a lot of fond, like the same way with the Hulk, there's a lot of fond memories of the 70s TV show.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm very excited by the fact that Arrow is expanding, because we're both big Arrow fans.
Mm.
And I think that the fact that they're going to expand it out, they're going to give us Black Canary, they're going to give us The Flash in three episodes.
And probably Arsenal or Speedy of some kind.
I think it'll be Arsenal more than Speedy, because Speedy just sounds stupid, which is why they gave it to the sister as a nickname.
Yeah, so we've got a Speedy in the series, but just not this one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I'm excited. Now, we kind of rushed past it. This documentary on Gestalt, when was the release date on
this? The release date is, I'll just double check the dates, I believe it's August 10th, I want to say, but that doesn't sound about right. So I'm just going to look that up right now.
I'll be definitely tuning in to have a look at
that. Yeah, it's on ABC too if you're in Australia, on iView if you can't tune into ABC for whatever reason. International viewers may not be able to see it just yet, but it did screen at San Diego Comic-Con, is my understanding.
I did like the fact that in that trailer you can see a little glimpse of Tom Taylor in there, who, you know, our mate Tom Taylor.
Yeah, well, he's a big part of the success of...
For those who have been listening to this for a while, you know that he wrote The Deep.
Okay, so it's August 13th. At 10 p.m. on ABC 1, not ABC 2.
Oh, ABC 1.
And it's going to be that week and the following week as well. So there you go.
Excellent. So I'll definitely tuning in to have
a look at that. Although I'm sure I saw somewhere else it said ABC 2. There's a reason I've written down
ABC 2. It's probably ABC 1 and then onto ABC 2.
ABC, I think it might be replayed on ABC 2. Yeah. So,
it's usually the case with ABC. That's Australian Broadcasting Commission Corporation?
Corporation.
Not the American
ABC. Yeah. So, but it will be on... online. Hopefully they'll Madman will eventually release this on DVD.
Well, what will happen in America is it'll probably end up being on BBC America or something like that, because that's sort of where this sort of stuff goes. So,
but excited about that, because it's just good to see Australian comic book industry getting the exposure it deserves.
Absolutely. Especially Gestalt. They're releasing some great stuff.
Gestalt are the premium publisher in Australian comics.
What if Christian Reed will be on that documentary?
I wonder. Yeah, well, we saw Justin Randall, who we've done an interview with. He's in the documentary. Tom Taylor, who we've also talked to. He's in there. So, look, you know.
Eventually, we're going to interview you, Wolfgang. So, just keep
yes, no, well, I've been in. I've had a long email exchange with Wolfgang. So, I just need to finally, we need to be in the same place at the same time. And,
yeah,
and
absolutely. Talk, we'll have a chat with him about the actual business side of it.
Yeah, well, I might see in the lead up to the documentary being screened. Let's see if we can grab
absolutely.
Him for
it'll
half
be
an
interesting.
Hour. Yeah.
Okay.
Right, so...
So there was news to talk about after all.
It turns out there was. All right, well, this is the second part of the show, which is when we're going to do the list. Now, we've got a very, very special thing happening in the second part of the show. We've got Paul Bedford joining us via Skype for the second half of the show. So just after the break, we'll be joined by Paul Bedford.
Well, see how you like this.
What is it, Batman?
Whatever it is, it's...
It's the pick of the week.
A young man is visited by an angel bearing a bloody quest to fulfill the new commandments. Is it an angelic vision or symptoms of a mind going mad?
It's a 200-page psychological horror. I wrote the original script about 99. I lost every single copy, hard and soft, until I moved into another house in 2004. And I was unpacking, I found the script, adapted it into a graphic novel format, and sent it out to a few guys, and Mr. Harvey Burnshaw was nice enough to introduce me to Henry Pop, who is the penciler on the list. And over a massive gestation period of 5 years, we produced the book you see before you now.
Already optioned for a big screen adaptation, this is The List.
And joining us in the second half of Behind the Panels is author Paul Bedford. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, guys. I've been looking forward to coming on all week. It's very, very nice after prenatal classes.
Paul, this is obviously not the first time that we've chatted. We had a chat at Supernova, and I ran into you again down in Oz Comic Con recently. And yep. So, how long have you been doing the con circuit with this book?
God, it. Let's see. I reckon my first, actually, the list, volume one. Now I can roll back and get stuff because this is an audio interview, right?
It
not
is.
A, not a
yes.
video one. Okay, good. So it doesn't matter if I sort of pick
you
my nose.
You can do it naked
that.
If you want.
The very first con I ever attended because I never knew conventions existed or. Well, I'd never written a comic before, so I didn't know about these things. Was a small indie con, not that any of the big ones existed, but a small indie con called Dugicon, run by Avi Burnshaw in Melbourne, who used to run a con, run a Japanese, like a anime, sorry, manga anthology called Oztaku, and all that sort of gear.
Yeah.
So the actual launch of the list volume one back, I'm just showing you guys. I know,
yeah,
I realize it's audio. I haven't forgotten
that's
that.
It's a nice cover.
Actually, 2006 was the first one when Henry brought along a first 20-page sampler.
Oh, okay.
Wow. So, and since then, I've been doing probably one or two cons a year, usually just the Melbourne ones, Supernova. That's where I met you guys first. I was lucky enough to be a guest there for the first time in Sydney, and Armageddon, and now Oz Comic Con, which is just sensational. Armageddon I probably won't do again. I won't get all controversial as to why, but Supernova and Oz Comic Con are incredible, incredible places.
I really hope to be getting to... Oz Comic Con next year. I couldn't go this year, so Richard was there by himself, but really looking forward to it next year.
Love the Oz Comic Con.
Oh, how well set out was it?
It was beautiful. Such a beautiful building down there in the Royal Exhibition Hall as well. Except the list, on the other hand, does go to some very dark places.
yes.
And I guess it's fair to say that it is a very darkly themed book. It's called Psychological Horror, I think you refer to it as. But I was kind of interested because I've read this a couple of times now.
Yeah, as have I. So.
And yeah, we've both sort of gone through this. And we kind of, one of the things we're interested, we know... sort of where you came from in terms of writing it as a screenplay first, but where did the idea come from? You know, where did the idea of the list first come about for you?
Okay, I think the idea sprung from going through a relatively crap time of my life. And I think any sort of writing that resonates with people comes from a pretty honest place. So I wasn't actually hit with an idea. I was more hit with a lot of like rage and sadness, insecurity, a sort of lack of a direction in my life, all things like that. And I just spewed it onto the page, and it came out in the form basically of the story you see now, although I was in my Fight Club stage. So it had a little more sort of like anti-establishment themes running through. It's like, I'm not Chuck. Just let it go, Paul. It really came from a place of dread within me. And it was very much like James O'Barr sort of says, like it's an excellent purging of demons is to... The simple process of getting your thoughts out of your head onto a piece of paper is quite a cathartic exercise. Especially like a lot of guys go through a lot of crap, and they sometimes it comes out the wrong way. But if you can turn it into something constructive, that's great.
You can definitely see all of that rage and everything on the page. How much alteration is there to the final product to when you first spewed it out on the page?
Right. Let's see. I would often come home drunk from clubs or pubs, or just sit home on my own like a sad old bastard and write stuff, lost in my little what's the word? I can't think of it right now. It's an impressive word. It'd sound good if I could say it. existential sort of meanderings and right there, and a lot of it was very much like I said, very much a vomit onto the page. After that, I tempered it into a half-readable story that hopefully would resonate with the reader. It was very much like I said at the start to you guys just a couple of minutes ago. It's the first comic I'd ever written. Like I'd never read comics, and I never written comics, and it was just for me because I could see the story playing out through my head. I sort of instinctually chose a visual medium with which to convey it. So there was quite a bit of tempering, as any writer would tell you, to get it to a readable stage. But I would say maybe a good 12 or 13 drafts.
Oh, wow.
Before it was half decent, yeah.
How much input did you have on the artwork itself? Did you, help storyboard out the piece in the first place, or was it all the artist's interpretation?
Well, there's two sides to that. There's my answer, then there's Henry's answer. My answer would be that, which is what happened, was I wrote the script, sent it to Henry, and basically, apart from a few interactions... he just went ahead with it. He's the sort of artist who can, and maybe he saw that I'd never written a comic script before. He's like, "Christ, this guy needs some help. I'm going to give it to him." And he was good enough, being a storyteller visually himself, to be able to combine panels, maybe alter some panels. And now and then he'd tell me about it, that he'd done that, and that was great. Other times he'd write to me just for a bit of clarification, but I think the reason he could do that, and that he's pointed out jokingly a couple of times, is that I'm quite anal and quite strict with my scripting. I'm very much unlike writing pages and pages. I'm very much a structuralist when it comes to even down to page structure, per page, per panel, camera angles, what to show, what not to show. And the like, which I think with you guys having read the list, you'd know there's stuff that must be hidden until the reveal. Mm. So, yeah. Yeah, so
we might get into a slight spoiler section later about the reveal, but we'll work into that.
that's fine. Look, I did read today on your website that it's did you say spoiler? It's going to be spoiled or spoiler free? I know that might either way.
It doesn't matter. We generally, when we talk about the comics, we generally think that if you've got to get deep into it, and sometimes you have to talk about spoilers in the book. We are like a discussion of the book.
Well, you know what? That would be incredibly refreshing because most times I have to talk around it. So if you guys want to spoil it and people are quite willing to listen to that, I'm quite happy to talk about it because it'd be quite a refreshing thing to talk about.
All right, then for our listeners, we're going to put a disclaimer out right now that says that anything from this point onwards may be spoilers in the list. And if you know, if you want to read the list before listening to the rest of this, you might want to pause and come back to us at a later time. So we put that disclaimer out there so we can basically talk freely about the book. How's that sound?
Awesome. All right. That's great.
Well, the other thing, I remember when you were talking to us last time at Supernova, you were saying that you'd actually lost every copy of the screenplay for a couple of years. So when you finally came back to it, how much of that did you look at? And when, you know, working it into the graphic novel format, how much did it change from that script?
As you guys might have known, it's originally written as a screenplay, which is the copy that I lost. I originally wrote the very first script in 1999 and then moved house and whatever else and life changed. Did a whole bunch. It was just something I wrote. I just wrote it, put it in a drawer. It's like, okay, that's good. I got that out of my system. And then 2004 came out and I moved into a new place and was unpacking and I found a printed hard copy and I just started to sit down and read it and it started to conjure all, sort of bring about all the feelings of the list and I really enjoyed reading it again. It's like, man, I really should stop stuffing around and do this. And funnily enough, it was at a time where I'd sort of lost my job and I think the list had come and found me. And from that graphic novel adaptation into its first sort of incarnation as a graphic novel from screenplay into graphic novel, there wasn't actually much change. It was very much I wish I'd have sent you a copy of this script. Very much like I was saying before, like a Fight Club anti-establishment sort of theme with just him walking around, and it had slightly different commandments and a few more. But it just, for me, it didn't have much grounding. It was more just me ranting in screenplay form. Mm. And so it had to find a real cohesive base to it. And that's where I started to think of the items that the items that are upon his chest, the commandments, or the new commandments, as I call them, being commandments. And from there, it led to, oh, well, okay, if they're commandments, then if they're the new commandments, obviously they have to be delivered by heaven. And how would that come about? And that's when the presence of the angel began to come in. But the angel was something I didn't want him to be like a guiding figure throughout, where he Matthew went to him and sought guidance. I wanted the angels to be, sort of be a background figure and not interfere too much, because he'd be interfering with the themes and also making it more of like too much like The Crow or something like that. You know, it seemed too derivative. So I wanted Matthew's his quest to be sort of pure and also without direction, which was basically where I was with my life, and hopefully the themes of blind faith would even subtly come through, because you know he just had faith that he would be able to get through this quest somehow, despite the odd misstep here and there.
Interesting. So, just out of curiosity, this has been optioned already. Is that for a film?
That's right, feature film. Yeah, that's right, Dave. Yep.
Here's a question for you then: how different is what's going to come out on screen compared to what you originally wrote? As a screenplay, okay. Are you going back to the original source for that, or are you going to the book?
Going to the book, definitely the book. It's the book that got the producers interested in the first place, and it is also the reason that the the film, that the screenplay is proving incredibly difficult to write. I mean, their screenplays are difficult enough to write as it is, but because the List graphic novel is an atypical structure where I just wrote it as I felt like I didn't adhere to any typical structure. I just wrote it how I felt like, and I've been, you know, sort of attacked by purists for it. It's like, well, you know, I just done what I want. I've just written things on a piece of paper, mate. So, you know, that's all I've done. And so, to the difficulties with the adaptation for screen has been following the classic three-act structure, which I totally agree with the producers must be. So a lot of the end where you only really fully get to meet the angel at the end, as you guys would know, and the reveal, well, some of the angel's introduction and how the new commandments come about is what will be focused, what will be the focus of the film, and what will be different with the film as opposed to the graphic novel. So a lot of it will... a lot of it will stick with the book, but there will also be the background characters, such as the girlfriend, such as the brother, and also a detective will be introduced to give the script a lot more flesh on the bones, because otherwise, as you know, if we filmed it just straight as it is, as the book, I think it'd be maybe, you know, an hour and 15 art house film, which I'd love to see it straight to film. I think it'd be fantastic, but the producers are looking at it being quite a hefty budget and quite a commercial release.
And is that an Australian production or is it being over to the States?
It's European, actually.
European,
yes, oh, yes, yeah. So and it's which is nice for a story like The List. I think they will have sort of European sensibilities, and they won't mind the down ending, and they won't mind you know, that they won't try to commercialize it in parts that it doesn't have to be. Like it will have to be commercialized to an extent to be what they want it to be, but also they are very big fans of the theme, the themes, the tone, the atmosphere. But I may have to tone down the violence. Which is probably sort of understandable.
Oh, don't do that.
Well, more implied. More implied.
More implied. Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I agree with.
Did you ever feel that you wanted to expand on that ending at all? Did you ever feel that you wanted to because as you said, it's got a very down ending, the angels reveal and so forth. And then it ends very abruptly.
Yes.
And with that photo of the family and the kids on the bed and so forth. And you sit there and go... I always made me wonder when I was reading it, was there more to the explanation as to the angel?
No.
No.
No. short answer, no. Long answer is that it was always my intention to have an ambiguous ending. And I discussed this one day in depth with Henry Pop at one of the Melbourne comic meets. And I was sort of a little confused about how to go about that. And so we had a bit of a discussion and came up with the ending as it stands. The ambiguous ending is intended to leave the reader and with something to think about. Like, firstly, you know, I've seen discussions online where, you know, you'll have one person saying the angel's real and the other people saying the angel's not, which is great because that's what I wanted to get across. Most people lean towards him being not a real angel. I'm not talking hallucination. I'm talking about whether he's an actual angel or it's a human being. Mm. A lot of people lean towards him being a human being. Others lean towards him being an angel. But the whole purpose behind the ending as it stands was to leave the reader with the thoughts that, well, look, you know, he's a guy that's, you know, been led through all this incredible darkness. He's got tattoos of new commandments. He's carved them off his own chest. He's now looking at his carved up brother tied to his dead mother while there's a guy in the room claiming he's an angel. So it's meant to leave the reader thinking that, okay, was this real all the way through, or it wasn't. That's where I want to leave it. I don't know if it worked or not. If it has worked, a lot of readers, great. If it hasn't, I can see why it hasn't. It's something I wanted to leave pretty much cut off, like right, you know, abruptly.
I think that definitely leaves you wanting more. It leaves you in that situation where you sit there going, I need to know more about this. I need to know what set this off, what set this chain of events. Mm. And then the inclusion of the photograph at the end, you're kind of going,
nasty.
Well, I sat there looking at that photo, and I actually found myself staring at that photo for quite some time.
Yeah.
Awesome. I love that.
Because I kept thinking, is the angel maybe another brother? Is it somebody related to them? What is the hint I'm looking at here? Why am I looking at this photo? And there's three people in that photograph, and you're going, okay, one could be the father, or is there another brother? What is going on here? And so I think, yes, I think mission accomplished. You left us going, what the hell?
No, that's good. That's what I was after. I didn't want a pat ending. And a lot of critics have sort of marked on that they've appreciated that. Especially, like, it does give an ending, but as you guys know from reading it, I just sort of drop you into it. There's no preface, there's no backstory, there's nothing. It's, you know, I wrote the story as it came out, and it just, you know, it is what it is. So I think the inclusion of the photo at the end, I really love your interpretation at the end there, and the fact that sort of made you take a little notice. My inclusion was, my reasoning for putting it there was simply just loss. It was simply loss. And just look what can happen to a family when someone claiming to be an angel comes into your life. The consequences of that.
I noticed when I saw you down in Melbourne that you were working on something new. When you were down there, are you working on something of a similar theme, or have you got kind of? Is there anything you can tell us about what you've got coming up with that? And actually, the more important question: are you working on more graphic novel work, or are you wanting to focus exclusively on films now?
I was working on the when you saw me down there, I was working on the screenplay. I was just taking notes because I was having a lot of trouble with bit of character conflict in Act One, because all these new elements are being introduced into the film. As you know, the Liszt graphic novel is a pretty abstract, sort of surreal experience. So trying to ground it is proving quite the task. I a couple of months ago, I went through a lot of crap, and I put up things like I didn't want to do interviews and all that sort of stuff, and it sounded. It wasn't meant to sound like a dick, but what I was trying to say is that I was going through a bit of crap, and I no longer wanted myself associated with my art. I just wanted to bring out the art. Anyway, that aside, I'll definitely be doing more graphic novel writing. It's something I love. It's as opposed to screenwriting, it's such a free and limitless. Limitless sort of medium that you can just completely let rip with without the constraints of budget or having to have connections or anything like that. And that's why I fell in love with it when I first started to write the Liszt as a graphic novel. It's like completely overwhelming, the fact that I can have as many pages as I want, and I can have anything happen all I want, and all I need is a good artist who can bring it alive. I don't need, you know, $50 million and, you know, a crew of 700 people working on it. So it can just be me and an artist, and we bring the vision to life, and there we go. And it became it's like a drug. The next works that I'll be working on, I have been working a long time on like an anthology. Is that the right word for a collection of short stories that you do yourself? I never get that right. And they're sort of they're sort of like got a bit of a philosophical sort of, you know, observations about life sort of stuff. So no one will like it. there's no violence and blood and stuff, so no one's going to read it. And so yeah, it's just something that's it's nice and cathartic to write. That it's you know, don't have to get all droopy about. But it's also nice to sit down and write a five page story and you go, oh, that's done. 5 pages. The story's done, as opposed to 200. You know, which the list is. So.
You're a remarkably humble person. Can I tell you? Can I tell you that?
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's wonderful. It's very refreshing. I will say the one thing I loved about the list is the atmosphere of the book. Mm. The atmosphere, I mean, it is just dripping in atmosphere to the point where I actually showed, I was carrying it with me to and from work, and I actually showed it to one of my workmates who is actually a very large comic book fan. Josh, we love you. You know who I'm talking about. All right. And I remember showing him going, this is what I'm reading at the moment. And I think he looked at about 2 or 3 pages of it and just went, wow, that's seriously disturbed.
Oh God, that's really worrying to hear, because firstly I came up with it, then I wrote 200 pages of it, and now I'm selling it with exuberance. Like that's
no, not and a I think that's
a, on my
I,
character.
I think that's a testament to how strong the atmosphere is in this book. Is
yeah.
You can pick it up,
yeah,
open no. it to any page, and go, holy crap, what am I looking at? You know what I mean? And
yeah,
I think
I've had times where I've sort of sat back from going, shit. You know.
But I've read it twice now, and I'm bound to read it again, I think, because yeah. I think there are, and I'm sure you're not going to give them away, but I'm sure there are secrets to unlock in this book if we actually delve into it, like that friggin' photo at the end.
Yeah, it's something that, like, I literally haven't sat down and analyzed it or have anyone analyze it, but it's funny when, and this probably happens to a lot of writers, and, you know, they might be interviewed and go, yeah, you know, I intended this, you know, Jungian blah 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 blah, or, you know, this Freudian, or, you know, whatever, and I had no idea what I was writing. So I think it's probably the fact that, you know, I was going through so much shit that it can be interpreted by the reader, or picked up by the reader, or, you know, it could be like some of the critics' reviews that I've read sort of, you know, go into the Oedipus syndrome and go into societal limitations on aspects of, you know, the personality and, you know, primal instincts and all this sort of stuff. I'm like, cool, that sounds fine to me. You know, they do an excellent sort of observation and written sort of critique of it, and you know, an appraisal, and like I'm like that wasn't intentional. I didn't not mean to put anything. I didn't mean to put anything in it. It just sort of came out, and that's where it is. So, if people are getting, you know, disturbed by it, mission accomplished.
It's funny you said that. I was reading something the other day where people were saying, well, in a lot of ways with comics, it's one of the few mediums where the reader does a lot of the work. We're actually making the connections between the panels. We're making the connections between we create the movement in our head. You know,
yeah.
All that stuff's happening. So in some ways, as you said, you just write it down on paper, and then, you know, the artist takes their pen to it, and then we're doing all this other work when you're not even involved anymore. So it's
yeah, spot on. I mean, look, I mean, how lucky I was to get artists like Henry Poff and Tom Bonin to stick with me through 5 years and 900 illustrations is an absolute testament to them, and I'm forever, you know, humbled and blown away by the fact they stuck with me when I see sort of so many projects around me just die, like, you know, some guys, you know, get halfway through a floppy and it sort of falls apart. To to have people come along who... If I start to go off the tangent, I just realize I've gone off on a tangent.
No, that's all right. I love tangents. I do it all the time.
I'm sorry. I just
our whole show is one big tangent.
Good. I feel reassured then, because I just got to this point where I thought, shit, I forgot what he...
We're sitting there really... listening to your every word. Now I feel like need more of an ending, the closure.
All right. Yeah. So, but what I'm saying is that, I'll continue on this tangent. It's so much to do with the artist's interpretation of it, and when I remember between the panels, behind the panels.
I'm behind the panels.
Because there's a lot behind the panel, because that's what the artist sees. If you're lucky enough to have people like Henry and Tom come along, and take your vision, and turn it into something that enhances it and gives power to your words, then consider yourself, you know, one really lucky writer. And the fact that I think a lot of the expressions and the angles and the shadows and the use of negative space within the list is absolute testament to them, because I didn't know. I mean, I'll say once again, just to point out how well how good a job they've done is the fact they've come along and worked on a script written by a first time, you know, writer. So yeah, thanks Henry, thanks Tom, I love you forever.
Look, one of the things that I just want to find out before we go is the fact that you got this done, as you said, over 5 years. It's self-published and you've done a really great job of marketing it online as well through Facebook and so forth. How are you with your next thing that you're writing and the next thing that you intend? Would you want to do it in a similar process, or would you want to do it through a publisher next time?
Let's see. Well, it's difficult to say, and look, it's because I never had any great aspirations to be a comic book, a graphic novelist, comic book writer, whatever you want to call it. The fact that it's done as well as it has. I realize it's not, you know, it's no Watchmen or anything, but I never had any idea what sort of reception it would get, because I'd never written, like I said, I'd never written comics, never read comics. I didn't know anything about the whole medium or the crowd or anything. The fact that it's getting good reviews and it's got, you know, people who like it, and the fact it's been optioned as a film, means that if it gets picked up as a film, I'll probably, I might get approached by publishers for my next, for my next project, which I've done, which whatever your writer does is write his fantasy trilogy, but I've done it in graphic novel form. So I've got 700 page bloody script sitting here. If anyone wants that, if anyone's listening, come along, fine, get someone to draw it. That's
that was
great.
A lot of paper you just held up
there. it's hefty, it weighs a lot, it's hard to read in bed. But look, I think that the current state of publishing with its limbo, with regards to ebooks and the fact that writers have direct access to Amazon, the fact that they can become publishers, like I've become an actual publisher, although I only publish my own book, I am a publisher, I can take on other titles if I wouldn't wanted to, but the fact you're so empowered in this day and age means that the attraction or the need to have that traditional gatekeeper has probably been removed somewhat, and if you put the groundwork in, and if you really if you're lucky enough like me to have two great artists come along and work on your work and bring your work to life, you will find an audience, and don't expect millions of sales overnight, and I certainly don't get them. But I it does okay. But it's more satisfying to see your creation sort of come to fruition by your own hand, and also to be able to have to maintain creative control over it, to be able to not get 2 cents per copy that you sell, and also to be able to retain all rights. So they're all great things. And like, if you're a writer or an artist out there, or writer artist, as a lot of my creative friends are, it's all just waiting for you. You know, you just got to sit down, put the work in, realize that you will have to not just be, as much as it's nice, you can't just be the guy who sits in front of his computer and then releases it in the world and hope it does well. You really need to sort of put it out there, you know, and push it, because I tell you what, it's an ocean. it's a David and Goliath daily battle. But at same token, if you're a little bit patient and you realize that, you know, you've got everything sort of within you to make succeed, then go for it. You know, sort of do it off your own bat.
Amazing advice to anybody getting out there.
Absolutely. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Behind the Panels. We wish you the best of luck with your next book and the other major delivery you've got coming later in the year.
we'd also like to extend an invitation out to you, Paul, that if any time you want to come on and talk about somebody else's work, you're more than welcome to come back on the show at any time.
Yeah, I would love to. That's great. And look, I just want to thank you guys for your amazing support and for having me on tonight. Your incredible podcast and great to listen to. Thank you very, very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Paul. And one thing we ask all of our guests is if there's a song you would like us to play out at the end of the show.
All right. Awesome. Awesome. That's a great question. I would like, let's see. I would like Tool.
I thought 40, you might.
46 and 2. Is that all right?
Easily done. And I'll let you know, we played the show in with Parabola. So.
Oh, Lord. Nice. Yeah. Very nice.
So, 46 and 2. It absolutely is one of my favorites, too.
Fantastic. So,
cool, Paul. Thank you so much for chatting. And we'll definitely get you back on again at some stage.
Absolutely.
That'd be great. My pleasure. Thank you so much, guys. Fantastic.
Thanks, Matt.
See ya.
And thanks again to Paul Bedford for joining us to chat about his graphic novel, The List. We first met Paul at Supernova this
absolutely.
Year.
And you can actually find that video at our website. So go and have a look at that prelim little interview that we got for him.
Our website, of course, is behindthepanels.net. You can find us at facebook.com/behindthepanels as well. You can hit us up for feedback at feedback@behindthepanels.net or, of course, through the Facebook page. You can find Paul in two places. You can find him on Facebook is the main place, facebook.com/thelistgraphicnovel. You can also find him on Twitter at pbedford. David, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at David McVeigh or at my master home, which is geekactually.com.
You can find me online at Twitter at DVDBits. You can find me at, of course, behindthepanels.net and therealbits.com. And you can find me weekly writing for Best Shots at newsarama.com as well.
And don't forget that you can help support this show by shooting over to our Cafe Press site where we sell t-shirts and mugs and so forth. And that'll help. Every dollar there goes towards getting this show up and running and getting it out the door every week. So have you got anything more to add?
More importantly, the other way to support us is, of course, as always, we ask every week if you can hit us up on iTunes, leave feedback, leave a rating. We've noticed a couple of people have left a few star reviews there, so keep that up. That's how we get more attention on this show.
If your review is really funky, we'll even read it out on the show.
Exactly. That's the most important thing. Any feedback you provide, we always read it out on the show.
Absolutely. Although, several weeks ago, I think we got an email from a Mario, which we haven't read out yet. We'll do that next week.
Next week, Mario.
What is our next week? We're off next week.
We're taking a week off next week because we're going to be at Smash, the Sydney Manga and Anime Show. So that's going to take it at us next week. So we're going to go and see that. You'll probably see a few interviews and specials coming up as a result of that. And of course, lots of cosplay photos on the site.
Always.
So we're going to take next week off, but then we're going to come back the week after that. Now, depending on what embargoes tell us that we're allowed to do or not do, we'll probably be coming back with Kick-Ass 2 review.
And if we are embargoed, we're coming back with
Age of Ultron.
That's right.
Either way, there are next two picks. So if you haven't read Age of Ultron, start reading that now. Otherwise, we'll come back and see you very shortly.
And I also believe Age of Ultron, we're going to have our good friend David Longo back.
Yes, we will.
Yes, absolutely. So it's going to be good stuff.
We're looking forward to that. But until then, I'm Richard Gray.
I'm David McVeigh.
And this is Behind the Panels.